Chapter 11 and chapter 12, we kind of broke into chapter 11 last week, but now we're really going to get going. So, the age-old question is this, is Lex Rex or Rex Lex? Remember that? You ever study that? Is Lex Rex or Rex Lex? That's Latin. Lex means law, Rex means king. Is the law king or is the king law? In the United States of America, it's supposed to be that the law is king. The president doesn't, or no person can overrule the law. The law is king. All right? In some form of government, the king is law. What form of government would that be? Pure dictatorship. I mean a true dictatorship. Okay? So the law is king or the king is law. Now the Medes and the Persians, which would they have had? Was the law king? The law was king, wasn't it? Now, the king was powerful, and he was, you know, everything in some ways, but once a law was written, that law was king. And that was one of the things that they really brought to the world at that time as a concept that even the king is not above the law. Okay? When they left and the Greeks came in, was it Lex Rex or Rex Lex? Was the king law or law king? And initially, he flipped it back with Alexander the Great, didn't he? The king was law. And we're going to study a lot of figures today, and you have to sort out that little horn of chapter 7 and the little king that rises and the willful king and all that in chapter 11 and so on. We're going to be bouncing between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Antichrist. And sometimes when you read Daniel chapter 11, in fact, all the last parts of chapter of Daniel, you're trying to figure out, you're talking about this pompous, proud, arrogant, blasphemous guy. And you think it's the Antichrist, and all of a sudden you realize, no, it's Antiochus Epiphanes. And then the next time you read about this proud, pompous, you know, blasphemous guy, and you think it's Antiochus Epiphanes, oh, no, it's the Antichrist. And you got to kind of figure that out. And some people don't. And some people, like the liberals, say there's just one guy. It's Antiochus Epiphanes. There isn't a such thing as an Antichrist, whatever. By the way, I offered this last week. If you did want to read a historical novel, this is a great one, Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll give you a great historical perspective on that, so you may gladly take that if you'd like. So we're going to start in Daniel chapter 11, and we're going to go through chapter 12, and we're going to finish it up tonight, and hopefully we will enjoy all about it. It's the rise and the falls of the Greek kings. Suddenly the focus seems to be on the Greek kings, and in particular, one little Greek king, and he prefigures another king who will come at the end, so he's going to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes a lot in chapter 11. But he's going to slide right over the Antichrist, and you won't even know what happened until you go, whoa, something's a little different here. I don't know if this is right or not. And so we got to kind of decide if that really happens or not. So we're in Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. It says, also, in the first year of Darius the Mede. So the also says this is his fourth vision, which started in chapter 10. And he said, also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer. Remember in Daniel, remember the chapter 2, we have, you know, the image. And the only clue we really had was the first one, the head of gold was Babylon. It's the only one that is directly stated to us there. Our logic and our history studies has told us, you know, it goes right on down to the Medes and the Persians, the Greek, the Romans, and whatever. But you don't have any direct statements of it. But as you move on in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, you have the same four kingdoms with Christ returning. And you now are filled in about the Medes and the Persians. So we've got the second one, you know. And then in chapter 10 and 11 and 12, he's going to start more and more. He's going to talk about Greece, even though Greece really wasn't on the chart yet historically when Daniel was writing. So now we have the third one. And so you gradually are building more and more information. And that's the way prophecy, especially in the book of Daniel, is written. It's kind of like going over the same stuff, only the next time you go over it, it's bigger and broader and different and gives you more and more and more information. And so that's very helpful. By the way, that's how you should probably read a lot of books as well. And that's how you should study a lot of topics. You should go over it fast the first time. And you don't get it all. Don't worry about that. You didn't need to get it all. You got the big picture, all right? Then go over it again. And now you got the big picture plus a little bit, and now you can fill in some little cracks and details. And you do it again and again and again. And I know when I prepare messages, I do that all the time. You know, I preach it in my mind on Monday, Tuesday, and every time I fill in more and more cracks. You just got to do that. And I learned that from the Bible because that's what the Bible does. It doesn't just tell you it once. It tells you it. So I'll tell you it again. I'll tell you it again. Fills in all the details. It's the first year of Darius. So that makes it, remember in chapter 10, it was the third year of Cyrus, the king. Now, assuming they were the same first year, which most of us do, that means that chapter 11 happens before or after chapter 10. Yeah, it would. Yeah. So chapter 11 is going to happen before chapter 10. What's that all about? What's going on? Well, it even tells you that in this prayer that he had in chapter 10, remember it was 21 days that kept coming up? It might have been not just 21 days, it might have been actually 2 years for the prayer ultimately. So what we're going to go is, in chapter 10 it was like here in history, third year of Cyrus and Darius. Now he's told you all that's gone on, how there's angelic warfare to go on, whatever. Now he's going to take you back to when he first prayed, when all this first started. It might have been actually 2 years in front of that, which is a very, very significant fact about it. And for 2 years, there's been a battle going on to get this message to Daniel. At least 21 days, but probably 2 years. And suddenly, we're going to get the answer. The other way to look at it, with the 21 days and 2 years, would be this. It was 21 days from the time Daniel started to pray that the answer came. But God had started the answer 2 years before. In other words, God had started to answer that prayer 2 years before the answer came. And Daniel started praying only 21 days. In other words, God often starts to answer your prayers long before you ever thought about it. Long before you ever brought it to him, he was already moving the events of history to accomplish what you were. So in chapter 10, verse 21, but I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. I'm going to tell you now what it is. Now he jumps back 2 years and he says, in the first year of Darius, long before you started praying, perhaps, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. The real question there is, who is the him? And of course, it depends upon a little bit on what you thought about who was the person speaking at the end of chapter 10 and whatever. Two options are in front of you. You recognize that it could be Darius. I stood up to confirm and strengthen him, him being Darius the Mede. He just talked about him. That could be the antecedent. But the more likely is, I stood up to strengthen or confirm and strengthen him being Michael from chapter 10. In which case, for 2 years, something's been going on. God's been working history and events. And Daniel just dawned on him 21 days ago, you know, which is usually true about us. So that's all going on. Either way, there is a divine intervention to bring to pass the establishment of this new kingdom, which was so favorable to Israel. And so God is going to step in, either by moving into Darius' life or else through this Michael, the archangel. Now, verse 2, I will tell you the truth. And he just kind of tells us, three more kings will rise in Persia. Remember, we're in the year of Darius and Cyrus, three more kings. But what's really important is not those three. The fourth shall be far richer than them all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. On your notes here, the three more kings, and then the fourth will be far richer and stronger and whatever. Remember Darius / Cyrus in 539 to 530 was followed by Cambyses, Cambyses. Then pseudo, which means false, Smerdis, Smerdis. That is because in some way he was an imposter, but he did rule. And then there was Darius the First and his high status, Hystaspes. You can look back in your other notes for that. So you have Darius and three more kings. Those are the three. And then the fourth was going to be far richer, and his name was Xerxes, or sometimes called Ahasuerus. All right, and that should be A-H-S. It's misspelled in yours. It's not Ash. It's A-H-S-E-R-U-S. And that's, of course, found in the book of 2 Kings, but it's also found in Esther. All right, so you can study that in the Old Testament as well. And that fourth one, Xerxes, was far richer and far more power. And history would prove that to be true. He just really was the most powerful king of the time. He was the pinnacle of the Persian power and glory. Remember, every time we find somewhere where there's a kingdom or a king who finally says, this is not great, Babylon. Every time there's the pinnacle of power, every time things are going as great as it is, watch out. You know, that's usually the beginning of the end. He had an army, as I said earlier, of 800,000 men, standing army of 800,000 men, all kinds of things that would happen to him. But the interesting thing says he will stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now, if you look at the map, what happened in 480, which was somewhat into his reign, Greece is actually starting to develop as a nation. And all these were city-states, Sparta and Athens and Pella and whatever. And they always were fighting amongst themselves, but suddenly they started to cohese and start to get together. And so Xerxes leaves over here, and he goes all the way across here, and he's going to take him on. So it's such a party that he brings his whole family with him, and he's sitting on a beach. And there's a battle of Salamis, which is right off of what is today, here is Corinth, down in here. And right back in there is Athens. You can see right in there, this little sea right here. And so Salamis is right there off Piraeus, which is the port of Athens. And his ships came against the Greek ships. And he was sitting on the beach with his whole family and all his armies. And he was just going to have a great time watching them get beat, or watching the enemy get beat. And to his amazement, it was a shameful defeat. I mean, just they went up in smoke. It went bad. Well, he ran for his life, got back in 480. He came back. But by 479, they had followed him, and ultimately they had defeated him, his army as well. He would make it back. They did not defeat the Medes and the Persians yet, but they had defeated the biggest king and the greatest king. So Xerxes was attacked the Greeks in 480. His army was defeated in 479. The navy was defeated in 480 at the Battle of Salamis. By the way, if you ever get on the internet and Google, you know, you can pick up all these things so nicely on the encyclopedias and whatever. You can read all about it, how many ships they had and all that kind of stuff. It's very, very interesting. And Xerxes never recovered. He never was as great again. He had been defeated. He had to kind of stay home from this point on. And the Greeks never forgot it. And remember, late, we had studied Alexander the Great and all that. He was stirred with wrath against the Medes and the Persians, not because of this battle, but other battles. But they never forgot this, and life would never be the same. The question you have is, why go only through Xerxes and not to the end of the Medo-Persian kings? Because remember the list of kings that we had, Xerxes, and there's a whole bunch more before Alexander the Great. Xerxes is going to die in 465, right there on your chart. Alexander the Great is going to come in 336 at the earliest, 335 perhaps. So you got about 130 years, and there's a whole bunch of Medo-Persian kings. Why are they not listed in Daniel chapter 11? Why jump from Xerxes to Alexander the Great? Partially because they never became a world power, yes? And partially because the focus of chapter 11 is on Greek kings. And the last Medo-Persian king that really impacted the Greeks was Xerxes. And once that battle had been settled, it was only a matter of time in history before we got to the real Greek king. So what he is doing there in that first section is this, the causes of the rising of the Greek kings. Why did the Greek kings come about? And he's just trying to communicate that. And if he could just get you to Xerxes, you got it all figured out. By the way, that would explain, does explain, as we studied last week, why so many gracious things were done in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah towards the Jewish people. Just go back to your land. Build your walls. Build the temple. We'll provide everything. You know, it sounds totally out of character. They are trying to build up the Israel so they can be a buffer to them. So those are the causes of the rising of the Greek kings. That's verse 1 and 2. Verse 3 says, then a mighty king shall rise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even from for others besides these. You understand quickly, this is the conquest of the greatest Greek king. And we have read him before. His name is Alexander the Great. So this is like the third or fourth time we bumped into him in the scriptures. You read about him in Daniel chapter 8, verse 5 through 8, and Daniel chapter 8, verse 21. Daniel chapter 7 actually had talked about him. And it's just kind of building your knowledge of it. He rises as a mighty hero king. He rules with absolute authority and power. So we went from Lex is Rex to Rex is Lex. And that often happens if you find problems in history where a weak government is replaced by a strong dictator or vice versa. And then the people get sick of the strong dictator, did whatever he wants. So they want to go back to law as king. And then that doesn't work for a while. And then all of a sudden they say, we have to have a strong leader. and it goes back and back and forth, and you understand it. So he rules with absolute power, and finally he does according to his own will. That is really the rex is lex, the king is in control. Of course, we know that to be Alexander the Great. When he has arisen, well, how will he ruin? Well, when he has arisen, again, we have studied that before, when he's at his peak, when he seems to be at his greatest power, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds. And we studied that before in Daniel chapter 8 and whatever. And we understood that there were the four generals. There were actually a conflict about five of them, but four of them actually ended up with that. And we studied those names. You've seen them before. And it goes to the four ends of the heaven, four winds of the heaven. Remember, we have bumped into that phrase before. And maybe now we understand a little bit more what it means, because what he's just saying is north, south, east, and west. And we might have tried to make more out of it than we needed to. But there are four kings in those four regions. So we've gone from what caused the rise of the Greek kings to what were the conquests of the greatest Greek kings. This is told to Daniel in 539 B.C. and it's fulfilled by God in 336 through 301, ultimately, by the time it's all broken up into the four kings. 539, with the beginning of Darius. So that's what he said in verse 1, Darius, the first year of Darius. So the focus is now on four generals of the Greek Empire, yet we're about to enter a new stage. And this is, again, typical. He's got to give you some context, and he does it quickly in four verses, and now he's ready to tell you what he really wanted to tell you. He's really not telling you anything more than you've already known, maybe a few slight changes in the details, but he's gotten you right away to these four generals. And now he's going to go on to what's really important and what is chapter 11. And so they're going to enter a new stage of conflict between two of those generals. You were given last time a chart that looked like this, I think. And you were given an article that looked like this. And I'd encourage you just to read it. And I could give you other things. This is a very well done and kind of concise, and you can get longer ones and whatever. And if you look at this chart and read this, you understand how you can go down chapter 11, verse 5, 6, you know, whatever, and then you can match it up to history. Here's what you're going to find, according to page 2 on your notes here, the conflict among the surviving Greek kings. We have four generals who become basically four kings of four different empires. And there's going to be conflict, but the focus right now is going to be on two of them, the king of the south and the king of the north. They would be events that will take place over the period of about 130 to 150 years. There are events with over 135 specific items are going to be mentioned. It is selective events. He could have chosen 1,000 more of them, but he chose these. There are selective events and selective kings, and selective people. Of all the intrigue and all the things that go on, he chooses these for us and wants us to learn something from it. There's a seesaw of domination. And if you look at this chart, for example, in one sense, what it's trying to tell you by the bigger and the smaller is, in a sense, at the beginning, the king of the south was the dominant, was the powerful. And the king of the north, which was the Seleucid, the Antiochus dynasty in Syria, in that region, was always a little bit less than the guy in the south. But with time, and it would go back and forth, it's a seesaw of dominion and power, but in time it's going to flip. And at the end, we're going to bump into that last king of the north. So he's moving towards the king of the north. And then when he gets there, he's going to jump in time all the way to the Antichrist to get to what's really important at the end for the Jewish people. But all of this leads up to it, and that's what's going on. And so there's a seesaw of domination. And if you look at it, you recognize the king of the south and the king of the north, and he's actually going to take all of Syria as well, a part of Syria at least. So what's Israel? Where are they? Right in the middle. So if this king is attacking that king, and that king comes back to attack that king, guess where you don't want to live? If you've ever studied war, fortunately, most of us have never had to live through war. And in the United States of America, basically, we've never had any wars other than the Civil War. But if you went to Europe or any other place, I mean, my ancestors from the Netherlands, one of my mom's uncle or whatever, you know, when the battles were going on, and they didn't even want to be a part of it, you know, they didn't want to be involved in the World War II, but they were thrown into it. And as the armies of the British came into the Netherlands to free them, and the armies of the Germans are retreating, all these people lived there, you know. And people are bombing and killing and shooting, and you happen to live in that house, you know. And so the church that is associated with my family in Oosterbeek was totally destroyed, you know. And that's the way it was. Israel's right here in the middle. And in one sense, they were trying not to get involved. But you're just constantly involved in it. And so it's very, very crucial. That's what he's trying to do. And that's why he's trying to bring this up. Israel, how does this all play out for Israel? That's what he's trying to tell Daniel at this time. So those are Israel's caught in the middle. Specific details. You could read through this, and I just really do encourage you to do that. And if you've studied history and history books, or you can pick it up on as you Google or whatever. But as you study through it, you just, you know, what you will read in Daniel chapter 11 will be, you know, this. And then you read history and go, like, there's a real guy there. You know, his name was so-and-so, and he had a wife named so-and-so, and he had a daughter named Cleopatra, and he had a, you know, whatever. And it's real history. And so it's very intriguing. We're just going to pick up a little bit, some specific details. In chapter 11, verse 5, we're just going to do one or two verses here, and then you can read the rest of verse 20, because I could do it all night, and you could read it on your own all night. So verse 5, also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes. What's that all about? Well, the king of the south, obviously, is the Ptolemy line down in here, and it's Ptolemy the first. And the Seleucid family, which was supposed to rule here, they'd kind of, the Seleucus I, Nicator, had kind of get knocked out. So he had gone to Egypt and was living with Ptolemy the first as his prince. So the king of the south is really the powerful one. Seleucus I, Nicator, is his prince. And here's what it says in verse 5. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Just read with me this part, if you got those, or otherwise I'll read for you. The king of the south was Ptolemy, satrap, who later became King Ptolemy the first of Egypt, 323 to 282. And as you read this, you're going to read specific dates, specific names that really are in history. Historians know these people. The prince was Seleucus Nicator, or Seleucus the first, satrap of Babylonia, who had fled to Ptolemy in Egypt in 316 to consolidate their power against Antigonus, regent of the empire. So Antigonus, remember this guy, is trying to get powerful. He's kind of beaten up on these guys. So this guy, Seleucus, goes down here, says, hey, you're pretty tough. We're going to join forces here. The two of us will be better than him. And so he's kind of like his prince. They're going to try to combine forces and beat him. Seleucus eventually gained control over the lion's share of the empire from Asia Minor to India. And when they gained strength, then he, the guy who was the prince, Seleucus the first, actually then, as they beat up on Antigonus up here, he actually gains more control, and he actually goes all the way here, and he becomes a very powerful ruler. So that's just one example. In verse 6, it goes on. I got some dates there, so you might as well fill them in. 323 BC, Alexander the Great died. 316, Seleucus I, Nicator, was driven out of his own realm here, in a sense. To some extent, he voluntarily did it to gain power because Antigonus was coming after him. In 312, there is a Battle of Gaza. You can read about that as well if you pick up anyway. These are the battles amongst the generals that are going on. And this is called the Third Battle amongst the generals. And between Gaza and the Nile River down there, there's a place called the Battle of Gaza, it's called. It's a little bit south of there, actually. And down there, they actually consolidate their forces enough to beat up on Antigonus and knock him out and drive him out. So now Seleucus can go on, and he gains power, but Antigonus, they're backing him up, and he consolidates forces with these guys up here, and somehow they all end up in, it's Issus or Ipsus, I-P-S-U-S. And in 301, that is considered the battle. In fact, historians, amazingly, will tell you how little is known about it, when it is one of the key battles in all of world history, because that was what eventually settled the issue, and the Greek Empire was now officially broken up. Antigonus had tried to rule it. Ptolemy had tried to rule it. Seleucus had tried to rule it. The other generals wouldn't give up their land. They finally all fought to a draw here, kind of, and when they got done with that, there were four kingdoms, and they broke it up in 301. In 280, when you read chapter 11, verse 6, if you went on, and at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up. with those who brought her and with him who begot her. Here's what it says in your notes here. Years of fighting erupt between the Ptolemies and Seleucids. Now it's between south and north. Ptolemy the second, in a bid for peace, Ptolemy the second, king of the south, offers his daughter Bernice to Antiochus the second, king of the north, on the condition that Antiochus would divorce his first wife, Laodice, and make Bernice's son the heir. So there are all this maneuvering and whatever. And that's what it's talking about, his daughter and covenants and whatever. The marriage occurred in 252, but when Ptolemy II died 6 years later, Antiochus II called back his ex-wife, Laodice. She expressed her gratitude by murdering Antiochus II, her husband, and Bernice, and her infant son, and having and had Seleucus II, her son, by Antiochus II. You can just read these details. We can get buried in them. But as you read that, you realize that all of these will fit. You'll bump into Cleopatra. You'll bump into this king and that king. And those who study Egyptian history and that history of that time will find that all of it matches. We are not going to read down through verse 20, but that's kind of how it goes all the way through there. There are some conclusions. One is this. Initially, the king of the south dominates, but eventually he does not. It shows the ascendancy of the Assyrian Empire over the Egyptian, and that will play into Antiochus Epiphanes, who spends most of his time here in the Syrian-Palestinian area, and why he is so crucial to the history of Israel. Israel's location makes it a pawn between two conflicting power, and all this back and forth, whenever there's that kind of turmoil for hundreds of years, or a long period of time, I should say, 150 years, eventually there's going to be somebody who's going to step to the plate and become a powerful leader. And that's what have a political leader who becomes very, very powerful. So that's real quick over a lot of history, and you can read it and as well as I can say it to you. Any questions on that? All right. Well, let's go on, because we really want to get to verse 21. Verse 20 says, "There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle." So at the end, just before Antiochus Epiphanes comes on, there's one who comes on the scene, a Seleucid king. He imposes taxes, but he dies real quick. So now there's a vacuum, and in his place, verse 21, shall arise a vile person. So we are up to page 3 in your notes, and we have the contemptible Greek king. And from verse 21 down to verse 35, we're going to study about him. And I'm going to just talk like he's Antiochus Epiphanes, because I think he is, but as we go through it, I think you're going to find that's true, but that might not be accepted by everybody, although most biblicists and even the liberals would say that to be true. But let's read it. "In his place shall rise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by entreaties." His rise. He's a vile person. At the core of who he is, he's a wicked, wicked man, as my grandson used to say as he preached. He was a wicked, wicked man. He was talking about his grandpa, I think. But anyway, he comes in peace. He comes in peace, and he seizes the kingdom by intrigue. He comes with the force of a flood, verse 22. "With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken." So when he comes in, he's going to come in peaceably, but through intrigue. And then all of a sudden with force, he's going to throw everything out. And he's even going to take, verse 22, the prince of the covenant, which would be the high priest, Onias, in the land of in Israel at that time. The high priest at that time is called the prince because in a de facto way, he was the leader of the Jewish people at that time. They didn't have a king. They didn't have a David or something to be king. So the high priest was by default, the king or the prince at that time. And it says this in verse 22 as you move on down through here. "And after the league, and also the prince of the covenant," there's a covenant or a pact that is made with him. "After the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people." So his reign is characterized initially by a time of peace, but that's immediately removed. And he starts to show the true nature of his character. He's vile, he's wicked, etc., etc. And in the time of peace, he attacks, he robs, he acts deceitfully. When he comes up strong, with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, verse 24, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He will use the riches that he gains in a way that most kings had not used it. He used it to buy friends and to buy off enemies and whatever, and for his own gain. First Maccabees, by the way, if you study the Apocryphal, the Catholic Bible has the Apocryphal, First Maccabees chapter 3, verse 30. He feared that he might not have such funds as he had before for his expenses and for the gifts, which he used to give more lavishly than the preceding kings. And so he was a real slick mover. Promising peace, coming in with peace, establishing peace, but all the time he's vile and wicked, and he's a man of intrigue. He makes covenants with the prince of the covenant, Onias, but eventually he's going to murder him. He's going to come with a flood of force at time. He can be anything on a scale, and all that takes place. His rival, in verse 25 through 27, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. So he's going to get bigger and bigger, and this is still the king of the south, and it's pretty tough to take Egypt. If you've ever studied Egyptology, you recognize it is tough to take Egypt. They are surrounded by natural defenses such as a Sahara Desert. You're going to want to come from that direction, pretty tough. South and to the west is pretty tough. From the north, you've got the Mediterranean Sea. That's pretty tough. And from this side, you even have desert. You just got this one little land bridge there, and even then, the last 40, 50 miles, you got to cross on desert. And so they have been very tough, but occasionally people have tried to take them, and occasionally people have. And Antiochus Epiphanes says, I'm going to do it. And so he stirs up his courage, verse 25, against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yet those who eat of the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. As you study that rivalry, in the year 170 B.C., which, remember, Antiochus Epiphanes is about 175 to 163, somewhere in there. In 170, he's going to take him on, and they're going to go down to Mount Cassius, which is between the Gaza and the Nile. That's the one I was talking about. And there they're going to have a great battle, north and south, Antiochus Epiphanes against the Ptolemy. And as you study that in verse 25, 26, and 27, it's quite a great battle. And they go back and forth. Both these kings, verse 27, heart shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. Now he's going to start talking about the end. But the end, but the end, but the end. That's a key phrase from this point on. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. As you read that, there's a pronoun he. You got to keep figuring out who's he. Is he the king of the south or the king of the north? And it's sometimes very tricky to read that and figure it out. But it's the king of the north who has gone down. They've had a battle there. They've had this intrigue at the bargaining table as well. And he really does win. He comes back and he's kind of all flush with victory and all that kind of stuff. And so as he comes back in verse 27 there, verse 28, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. And so he thinks he's a big hot shot guy, and he comes back and he's coming through Palestine, and he's going to do damage to God's people, and he's going to take on the God of Israel. His ruin, verse 28 through 30. And you can read about that in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 20, and chapter 1, verse 60, etc. He will try again to go to the south in verse 29. The appointed time he shall return and go toward the south. And so the first time he went down, he was very successful, and he came back very rich. And when he was very rich, he tried to take on the covenant people. But he now thinks, well, I'm really great, so I'm going to really go down and clean this thing up and finish this off. But verse 29 says, it will not be like the former time. It's not going to go well this time. There's going to be a difference. Here's what's going to happen, verse 30. Ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved. All right. So what happens in 168, as he goes down, the first one was 170, he got beat the Egyptians here, but then went back. Now he's going to go on. Ships from Cyprus will come down, which is actually from this whole region here. By 168, this is starting to become Roman power, so we can even think of it as the Romans are going to step in. But the generals then will, when he gets there, the Roman general, the guy who was actually from Cyprus, the Roman general, comes to the defense of Ptolemy, and little Antiochus Epiphanes is standing there, and the Roman general with all of his fleet and all of his armies draws a circle around him with his sword. You remember this in history. You probably read this in history. And here's this little guy, this pipsqueak of a guy who's pompous and proud and going to beat everybody up. And the Roman general and Ptolemy are standing there going like, watch this. And they draw a circle around him. He says, you got a choice. You can either walk out of that circle or I can kill you. And you will walk out of that circle and you will take your army back. And I'll take what I want before you go back. So you have a choice. He had no ability to beat him. And he knew he was beat. Now you can imagine what it would be like if you're a pompous little guy who wants to rule the world. And some guy in front of all of your troops drew a circle in front of you and made you eat humble pie. That's why it says in verse 30, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant to do damage. Now he's coming back, not because he's rich, because he's angry. And he gets to the Israel, and man, in rage, he does damage to the covenant people. And so we have something about his rage. He vented it on Israel. You're in the wrong place, Israel. This guy is really, really mad. You read about he defiles with abominations. You can read about that in 1 Maccabees. You can read about it here. He says in verse, the people who know their God will be. Here's what it says, verse 31. The forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Remember that? We read about that earlier in Daniel. We can read about it in history. Christ talked about it in Matthew 24. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue. And some of those who have understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end. Again, a reference to the end, because it shall be for the appointed time. And so he's come back. He is doing the abomination of desolation thing in Jerusalem and in the temple. He's stopping the sacrifices. He's offering pigs. You can read about it. I just got one place that there's so much in the Maccabees. Of the apocryphal books, most of them you probably won't enjoy reading at all. And all of them are not inspired. None of them are inspired, I should say, and whatever, but you can kind of appreciate a little bit of what's going on. If I can find the spot here. Second Maccabees, where is that listed there? Somewhere? Do I have it? Maybe I don't. Second Maccabees, chapter 6, verse 19. Eliezer was the high priest at that time, and his boys, remember them? And everybody had to be eating pork, and you had to sacrifice a pig on the altar. And if your son was circumcised, they would take your son and kill him and then tie his legs around your neck if you were a mother. And you got to walk around with your dead circumcised son around your neck, and on it went. It's really horrendous. This is not inspired, so it might not have been exactly like that, but most people really don't question that it's that far off. And in 2 Maccabees chapter 6, verse 18, Eleazar, one of the chief scribes, a man advanced in years and of a comely countenance, was pressed to open his mouth and eat swine's flesh. But he, choosing rather a more glorious death than a hateful life, went forward voluntarily to the torment. And considering what manner he was to come to it, patiently bearing, he determined not to do anything unlawful because of his love for his own life. But they that stood by, being moved with wicked pity for the old friendship they had with the man, took him aside, desired that the flesh might be brought, which was lawful for him to eat, that he might make it as if he had eaten, so the king would assume that he had actually eaten the pork. But he would not do it, and therefore, for the sake of their old friend, he died. And Eliezer was the one who stood up and said, no, I won't do it. You read about that right there. We just read it. Those who do wickedly, but the people who know their God will be strong. And that's where the Maccabees come in. They were strong, strong people. They have a tremendous heritage. You can be very impressed with them. Can you imagine you're going to eat pork? I mean, what would be so bad about that? You're either going to die or eat pork. It's like, well, I mean, God doesn't really want me not to eat pork. That's not so great, you would think, but they wouldn't do it. So there was his rage was vented on the people. The people know their God. will be strong. The results, as you think about it, and we read it there, there's going to be basically a dividing of the people of God, or the Jewish people. There will be those who will give in to that, and to the intrigue of it, the deceit of it, the pressure of it, and they will actually become what they're supposed to be, uncircumcised. They will not circumcise their kids, and they will go to the gymnasium and be Greeks, and they will, on and on it goes. And then there will be the people who know their God, who will stand strong. And so we have that many will die, and many did, in the days of the Maccabees started. So, some fall for his intrigue, some stand for their God. So all this has happened in history. The amazing thing is, that's why I wanted you to have this, so that you're not just, I'm not saying it. You can actually read it, and this is a very short one. You can get longer ones. I have longer ones. 135 events, and they're all fulfilled. You can put Ptolemy the First with that. You can put Cleopatra with that. You can put Bernice with that. You can put, you know, Seleucus Nicator in that one. And it all fits. 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 To us, it's all past. To Daniel, it's all future. All right? Question we'd ask just before our break here is, what does this instill in us? What impact does that have in your life? Why do I need to read that? Why did Daniel need it in that day? I mean, he wasn't even going to live to that time. Why does he need to know the future? You know, what does all this do for us? Anything?
It instills a fear of God.
All right. I would encourage you some days to, I know we don't promote the Apocrypha, and I'm not trying to do that in one sense, but just to read the Maccabees, it would be very intriguing. And if you get the chance to read this book, just a historical novel. I love historical novels. It's very intriguing. Obviously, it's written by men and has flaws in it. It isn't perfect, but well, it'll give you a different picture of what it's like. What else you learn? Impact in your life. What do you think Daniel's done with this? He gets to verse 35, and what's his heart doing? What's his mind doing? Is he happy? Or is he sad? Is he encouraged? Is he discouraged? Is he...
He's overcome with grief, part of it, because he becomes like he's ill. And 3 weeks, causes his head with sack.
Yeah, okay.
Well, he might think that he stood against what was, you know, what was
right.
Wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, hearing this, maybe that makes him think, well, God was pleased with that.
Yeah.
Even though it happened, it was still, God still rewarded him.
Yeah. When you get to that 34th, 35th verse, and so verse 32 went on, the people know their God will be strong. He didn't know Eliezer even existed yet, obviously. We'd look back and go, man, that guy
sometimes
stood.
There's a price to be paid to take him the right step.
You better believe it. Daniel had learned that personally already and seen God do spectacular things in his life, his buddies' lives. And yet I'm sure they had also seen a lot of death and whatever. Okay, and sometimes there's a high price. What else you learn? What impact? What does it instill in you? As you read it, do you ever read historical things like that and start rooting for people? I do, you know. Like Job, all the way through Job, I'm going, Job, hang in there, buddy. Don't get mad now. Hang in there, buddy. If you only knew what was going on, buddy, you would not get mad. And so many times you just say, just trust God. Trust God. Hang in there, buddy. I know it's tough, but I know what's going to happen. I know the end. I think for Daniel, it brought hope, brought horror. I think for us, it brings hope, it brings horror. I think for the Jewish people, as they have studied this year through the years, it has brought hope, it's brought horror, especially as we read the next part where they have great hope in front of them. But they know they have tough days ahead. And I think he has gone through a lot of it here. So you are aware how tough it is. All right? Now, you ever have somebody who has led you on and set you up? God does that often when you read the Bible. You go, wow, I don't know how he did it. He's sitting and he goes, you haven't seen anything yet, buddy. If you think that's bad, wait till you read the next verse. Now we're going to the real bad stuff. So I think there's a lot of things that go on. It gives us confidence in God's prophecy. 135 items have been fulfilled. Those who say it's a forgery, do it because of chapter 11. It is so accurate. I mean, even if you could prophesy, you couldn't get 135 out of 135. You know, there's nobody could do that. And they did. He pulled it off. In the 3rd century in particular, that started already. Gives us confidence in God's plan. God is working. He knows way in advance exactly what's going to happen in detail. Sometimes in chapter 2 and chapter 7 we get big picture. Kingdom, 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 kingdom. Wonderful. Chapter 11, we're allowed to see 150 years in detail. Most of the time, God doesn't do the detail stuff for us. But once he lets us in on detail, you know what? He knows exactly he's going to be king. He knows he's going to give his daughter in the covenant agreement with that king. He knows that it's going to work out until eventually this lady comes back and kills her husband. And he knows all the details of life. Gives me great confidence in his plan. Some people say God knows the big picture, but he doesn't know the details. My friends, I think he knows the details. I think he knows every detail. I think he knows every minute detail. He gives us confidence in the godly heroes. And as you read it, you go, I wish if I was there, I'd be one of those people who know their God. I want to be one of those. I want to be one of those. My friends, you have the opportunity to do that every day, don't you? To stand for God. It's not as tough as what they went through. But every day we have that opportunity. So we have gone through the contemptible Greek king. And we think, man, can't get any worse than this. So we better take a break and then come back. All right? Enjoy.